This program is sponsored by Blazing Grace Ministries.
This radio program is PG-13. Parents strongly caution some material may be inappropriate for children under the age of 13. Send me free of the chains holding me.
Is anybody out there hearing me? Send me free.
Jesus' mission was to comfort those who mourn, bind up the brokenhearted, proclaim liberty to captives, and open prison doors for those who are bound. For those who want more than status quo Christianity has to offer, Blazing Grace Radio begins now. And here is your host, Mike Janung.
Hey, Mike Janung here. Welcome back to Blazing Grace Radio. Thank you for joining us on this battlefield called life. And if you've never heard of us before, you're just tuning in. We are a ministry to persons who struggle with porn addiction, sex addiction, adultery, any kind of sexual issues. We offer counseling. I've written books, speak at churches. We have groups going on during the week. So this week, we continue our conversation with David Zaylor. He is the founder of Operation Integrity, a Christ-centered organization that helps men and women face the reality of addiction and transform their lives. He is also on the faculty with the Leadership Institute, which mentors Christian leaders and champions Christ-centered recovery internationally. David lives in Laguna Niguel. I'd rather be having this interview there, California, where he is active in his community, enjoys running and cycling. David, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Enjoyed being with you last week, and great to be back again today. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks. So let's pick up. And last week you shared what must have been a traumatic situation when you lost your mother to suicide. And what was that like for you?
Well, it was words fail. I was not a young man. I was 27 when it happened. Well, 27 is certainly a young man, but I wasn't a child. So often people go, oh, they assume I was a child. And no, I wasn't. I was a young man. But my mother and I had forged a deep bond of health, respect, and deep appreciation for one another through a very difficult family life. And so I didn't understand for many years when she died and she used a gun. I was living in Austin at the time, my mother and father were living in Houston. When I got the call from my father that she had died and how she died, I drove straight there and was there in a few hours. And I remember cleaning up the bedroom. She had shot herself in the bedroom. And I remember cleaning up the blood and cleaning up the trash from the paramedics had been there. And, you know, there was a lot of medical waste, I guess, and plastic stuff. I don't even know what it was, but I was given the assignment by my father. He said, you know, look, you've got to clean this up. I can't handle this. And so I did what I had done with my family almost all my life, is that I was cleaning up messes. And I buried my anger. I buried my grief. I did what I had done almost all my life, is that I took my painful emotions and I stuffed them, and I just went about doing something, working. Years later, and in fact, it wasn't too many years later, and as a 27-year-old man, I had a business, and then on weekends, I would go out and I would drink beer and chase girls, because that's what a 27-year-old single man did. back in my day. And but after her suicide, my drinking became a problem. And I drifted into full-blown alcoholism. And then drugs came along. And for about the next 15 years, I would say 14 years maybe, I struggled with this periodic but highly dangerous use of alcohol and drugs, realizing, not aware, that much of what was fueling my addictions was unhealed and unprocessed grief. And so as part of my recovery work, I've had to go back and face the memories. And I've done some things, like I write about this in my Death of a Fisherman book. I spent, as you know, and as we've already mentioned, I live on the West Coast in Southern California. Both of my parents are now buried in Houston. And part of this, some years ago, I was shuttling back and forth to Houston to work on some content, some video series content. And every day that I was in Houston, I visited my parents' graves. They're buried side by side. And so I was in Houston probably 25, 30 days that year. And every day went to their grave. On the one side with my father, and if I had had a shovel, I would have dug him up and hauled his remains off to the dump site somewhere. And my mother, I brought her flowers every day. Mm. Every day I visit her grave, I brought her flowers. And I found myself realizing how much anger I had held against my father. And I realized how much anger I had against myself because I wished that I had known better to protect her, to care for her. And I sat beside their grave and I apologized to her for not being more appreciative and more attentive. Now, what I'm sharing with you is not uncommon. I think most of us, when we lose a parent, these times of great sadness are times of great reflection. And we come to terms with regret. And we wish things could have been different. We wish things would have been different. I know that I wish that I had done better in so many ways. And at the end of this year, or that year that I was traveling to Houston, and at the end of all of those trips to the gravesite, I finally made peace with the fact that it was what it was. And my mom's not holding a grudge against me. And for me to be holding a grudge against myself or against my father or anyone else was harming me, not them. So my mother's suicide is something that if I had the ability to go back and change life, I would. But none of us gets to do that. Mm-hmm. So I've learned to make peace with it, and I continue to just take the memories, I hold them, I process them, and I'm grateful for the fact that I'm so grateful, Mike, that my mother and I had a good relationship. It would have been so much more painful, and I'm not sure if I would have survived if I had not embraced her love and care for me before she left. Sorry for the long rambling response. I hope that wasn't
David. That was rambling. Not rambling at all. That was, I feel painful just listening to this story and the trauma and the loss and the grief. And so I'm appreciative that you're willing to go there. And and one reason that I wanted to do this interview with you when I saw what you've been through with your mother is because suicide is now the second leading death among youth.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one topic that needs to be up front in church today because there is an intense spiritual battle against youth and adults. I mean, I was molested myself, and I went through a period of time where I was very close to committing suicide. Mm-hmm. So talk first to the parent or person who has lost a loved one through suicide. What would you tell them?
Well, I've been asked this question before, Mike, and I always hesitate because I think people assume that with a question like that, that there's going to come an answer that makes sense and makes everything all right. Nothing about suicide makes sense. It won't. I do understand this. Is that the desperation that drives someone to such an act? It's not born of selfishness. It's not cowardice. It's someone has come to a place where they no longer see any hope to escape pain. That's it. It's an absence of hope.
Mm-hmm.
And and even in saying those words, there's an inability to convey the emotion or the experience that someone would feel. So if you came to me and you had just lost a loved one to suicide, I would not begin to assume that I understand exactly how you feel or exactly what was going on with your loved one before they took their life. I would just want you to know that you're not alone. One of the things that drives great desperation and is probably best termed in this thing that we call hell on earth, which is this sense of utter, complete isolation and loneliness. And at some level, I think we've all experienced that. We all know what it's like to feel lonely in a crowd. You can be with 100 people, 500 people, 1,000 people, and feel utterly lonely. It's not about how many bodies you have in your life or how many acquaintances or how many people you know. It's how many people know you? And how many people do you feel confident and comfortable in letting them get to know you? And my mom, bless her heart, she was utterly alone at the level of her emotions. And I have had similar feelings, certainly through my addictions. My addiction certainly took me through years of an agonizing wasteland of relationship. Sounds like you have experienced that too. I don't know of a human being out there that hasn't had some experience with this.
Yep.
And ultimately the answer is learning and finding places and people who can connect with common experience and common understanding. There's a real basic definition for the word intimacy that I use. It's knowing and being known. The great need of our day really has to do with intimacy. The knowing and being known. And we can do all kinds of religious calisthenics, go to church and Bible study and do all kinds of stuff, and still not have a whole lot of people who know us.
Yep.
And sadly, and this is, I think this was something that was horrifically painful for my mother, that she was a very dedicated Christian woman. And her my father, her husband, was a prominent church musician, and she was there sitting in the pew to faithfully support him several times a week in the church services. All the while, no one at the church took time away from their busy Christian lives to give her compassion and understanding. No one took her to coffee. No one invited her to lunch. Because they were so busy doing their ministry and the things that they did. And so when we hear about Christian people who fall into depression, mental illness, addiction, suicide, I think we need to back up and understand that there's a difference between an intimate encounter with our Lord and with other people, and it doesn't equate with religious activity.
Yep. Couldn't agree more. So when I go and speak at churches, I'll ask people to raise their hand if they meet with another believer once a week for the purpose of support, accountability, and prayer. And usually only 10 to 20% put their hands up.
Right.
And the U.S. Surgeon General put out a memo May of last year about the epidemic of loneliness. And the early church was devoted to fellowship, prayer, and teaching. We're not devoted to fellowship when 80% of us are isolated. So that's why I literally have people break up and share and pray with each other when I speak. So I just don't want to be a talking head up there.
Well, unless a community is a place where I can go and I can tell someone about my drinking problem, and that I can find other people with a common understanding, and that together we connect together to find solution and support with one another. The bottom line connection of fellowship is not with how great we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's the fact that we're a bunch of broken people believing in the love of God.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised in the church my entire life, and I had no practical understanding of that until I started going to 12-step meetings from my alcoholism. And when I would hear people talk about their brokenness, I would go, now that's different. And I didn't feel quite so alone. And somehow or another, as we came together to be honest about these areas of struggle, it's not just that we didn't feel so alone, but we quit hurting ourselves. That's where we found the strength and the support not to go drink anymore. And I think the same holds true in across the entire spectrum of these habitual areas of self-destruction, whether it's food, pornography, inappropriate sexual relationships, misuse of drugs, misuse of prescriptions, workaholism. And by the way, one of the most pernicious addictions that I'm aware of has to do with religious addiction. Boy, if you want to go get some pats on the back, just be a super committed workaholic in a local church. And boy, everybody loves you at the surface level. Until you crash and burn, and then they call it a moral failure. A pastor friend of mine down in Houston says it quite well. He says, yeah, it's amazing how in the church we can we sacrifice our own. Mm-hmm. And that's what I saw in my family. My mother, until she died, was our family's sacrificial lamb. As long as the whole world knew how sick she was, no one would ever know how sick the rest of us were. And as the family dynamics so often play out, once she was gone, I stood up and was the next in line to assume that role. And as I fell into my alcoholism and my drug addiction and my sex addiction, because along with the alcohol and drugs, I became very promiscuous and was out, you know, to bars and hooking up with women. Did that for years. And then I took on that role as the scapegoat. As long as everybody understood that, you know, Dave was the sick one, he was the troubled one in the family, no one would notice my father's narcissism. And you know what? Neither did I. Until I got some help and began to work a recovery program and got some time in sobriety and began to have a clearer vision for what was true.
You know, I've heard a statement in the support groups, but I'd be willing to bet that you've heard too, where people will say, "This is my church."
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Talk about that. Why is that their church?
Well, it's a place of shared faith. My kind of blue collar definition of faith is this: a hope filled belief that compels me to take effective action. It's hope and action together. I think so often when if faith is nothing more than a religious dogma that is indoctrinated without the flesh and blood of hope and without the kind of organic nature of connection, then people can work their tails off and they just drive themselves to burnout. Mm-hmm. And then they have to keep all their secrets. If people have to keep secrets in the place that they call fellowship, then they need to find a new place to call fellowship.
And in a church where 70% of the men and a third of the women are viewing porn, and you have large swaths of youth engaged in sexual sin and pornography, are we keeping secrets?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty safe assumption. Yeah.
And when those issues are not touched from the pulpit, are we keeping secrets?
The only time I generally hear those topics from the pulpit is to tell people to stop doing it. And most people that I know who struggle with these kinds of issues, and I'll just, for lack of a better word, I'll just call it these kinds of addictions. And by the way, addiction is not a matter of how often or how much. People are saying, "Well, you must have drank a lot." As an alcoholic, no, I really didn't. But it was the effect on my life. So if someone says, "Well, I only look at pornography once a week, I can't be addicted." Well, what's the effect on your life?
Mm-hmm.
If by viewing pornography once a week keeps you from having intimate encounters with your spouse for the next 4 or 5, 6 days, then you got a problem there. And so it's not a matter of how much or how often. It's the negative, destructive impact on the individual. I do know that this, the sermons I hear on such subjects have to do with just, okay, get right, repent, and stop. Don't ever do it again. The radical thing about an addiction recovery program is that people understand that we all know how to stop. Stopping is not the issue. Not starting the next time,
yep,
that's the issue.
Well, David, we got about 20 seconds left. Anything you want to say?
Hey, I want to say thank you. Thank you to you, Mike. Thanks to the station. Thank you to your listeners. sorry to ramble on. I'd love for them to look at my book, Death of a Fisherman.
No, you didn't ramble at all. There's a lot of good takeaways. So I love it, David. Thank you.
And all right. Thank you, Mike. All right. God bless to you and all. Take care.
Thank you, my friends, and we'll see you next time.
Do you want to be free?
Blazing Grace is a nonprofit international ministry for the sexually broken and the spouse. Please visit us at blazinggrace.org for information on Mike Janung's books, groups, counseling, or to have Mike speak at your organization. You can email us at email@blazinggrace.org or call our office in Chandler, Arizona at 719-888-5144. Again, visit us at blazinggrace.org. Email us at email@blazinggrace.org or call the office at 719-888-5144.
This program was sponsored by Blazing Grace Ministries.